The gospel reading this morning is taken from the Gospel of Luke, and it's a very famous, and you'll know this passage very well. But it is a good illustration of what we're going to speak about. Jesus looked up and saw rich people putting their gifts into the treasury. He also saw a poor widow put in two small copper coins. He said, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them, for all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put it all that she had to live on." Gospel of the Lord. It's always a very dangerous thing to talk about stewardship, because most times we think stewardship has everything to do with money and economics, and it really doesn't. That's a very small part of it. I'd like to begin by stating that there is a paradigm given us in the scriptures back in the book of Genesis of what God's intention or vision was in terms of stewardship. It's in the story of Adam and Eve, when creation has taken place and God has seen all that has been created. It's good and beautiful and wonderful. And he creates Adam and Eve and places them in the garden to care for it. They were the first stewards of creation. If indeed there's any truth to this metaphoric explanation of the creation of the world, it is a truth that forms the foundation of our belief system, of our cultural appreciation of who we are as God's people always and everywhere. And that is, we are caretakers of what is around us. Now, over the centuries, we've experienced a great deal, and I'm not going to go through a historical thing as much as just to kind of outline for my purposes the eventuality of what has taken place. You know, one of the groups of people that have always treasured and kept the earth as a gift and dealt with it not only in their manner of culture development, but also in their religious belief and in their rituals. All we need to do is turn to Native Americans, Native Africans, Aboriginal people, and we find among them a great appreciation of the creation of which they are a part. They take nothing out of creation that they somehow don't put back. They take and use only what they need and nothing more. Their lives are simpler. Their cultures are much easier. But in lots of ways, they do indeed live what we hold to be God's purpose of this earth and our place in it. That creation and the world's resources are here for all of God's people to be used equally. Now, back when the Garden of Eden, there were two people, there was no big problem. But as people began to grow and populations moved into aggregates of cities and towns, you know, they say this all the time about kids, you know, small kids, small problems, big kids, big problems. The same thing is true when you have two or three people. Well, let's go back to when I first came. We had a small group of people. We didn't have any problems. Now look at us. And one of our major problems is, how do we continue to feed a host of people whom we welcome? And how do we, as a church, use our worship service to really be inclusive of all the people's faith, of all of your attitudes and intentions, and at the same time, keep everything within an hour? It's a challenge. But that's not a problem. The problems that occurred with the multiplications of people came because cultures started to evolve. And as cultures started to evolve, belief systems got mixed in with the cultures, naturally. And we know the great Christian movement that came upon the world in the first century, that erupted into a great organized system in the third century, had wonderful things to offer. And let us be very mindful that no matter what we can say, you're banned, Teresa, no matter what we can say about critiquing the world around us, let us be mindful, too, that we have very much for which to be grateful. And we as human beings have come very far. But to critique is not the same as criticize. To critique is to take a prophetic vision of what is and step away from it as objectively as possible to see how we stand with the primary paradigm given to us in Genesis. If we are going to understand stewardship, we need to critique where we are. And how we got here was evolutionary. It was a few changes that took place, simple things like the Industrial Revolution, the Enlightenment period, when we all began to reason and use our heads, and science was born, and science became a driving factor in understanding the world. And all these wonderful things took place, and people's lives changed dramatically. Economic systems became much more complicated, and in every economic system that we have ever created, I think it is safe to say, in every economy in the world, the purpose of that economy was initially to ensure that everyone would have. And without fail, every one of those economies has created pockets of great wealth and great poverty. That's a given of the human condition. And dare I say that Christianity, in its wisdom, in all of its different forms and denominations, has gone pretty much along with the culture many times. I stand here as a person who participates in exactly what I should not be participating in because of living here in America, the expectations that we have, and the challenge of that first paradigm, that we are stewards and users of the resources to ensure that they are shared equally is a problem. All that being said, it is easy for me, for Coughlin or anybody else, to stand before you and offer you some challenges to how we go about our day. But I think it's very important for us to understand we as Christian people have been given a renewed paradigm. Now, the paradigm of Genesis goes back thousands and thousands of years. But in around the first century, Jesus came along and saw what has happened to the people in his life, this widow being one of them, a widow in a culture where widows were forlorn and on their own, where they had no identification, they had no resources, they had no way of survival except to beg. That was the life of a widow. Children were in that same category, and any other pariah of the culture and of the temple. Jesus saw that and came upon it, and he critiqued it. He didn't criticize it. He critiqued it. He looked at it and said, made a lesson like this. You see what's important to God? For all these people in the temple where they found themselves feeling very good about themselves because they were doing what God wanted according to the temple. They were doing all the things the government wanted, and therefore they were at peace. And so they considered themselves very, very, very safe and blessed. And yet Jesus sits there and says, you see all those people? They gave out of their excess. This woman gave everything she had, which is the other extreme. To give to the point where you are now destitute is a very foolish thing to do. And Jesus is not applauding that. What Jesus is applauding is the fact that in his world, there were very wealthy people, and they were the power people. And his critique of them was that they needed somehow to repent. I give you the story of Lazarus in Luke's gospel. Lazarus and the rich man. Lazarus, the poor beggar, sitting outside the rich man's house, who clothed himself in purple. And this guy was begging at his gate. And every day, every time he went in and out of the gate, the rich man went by and never even noticed him. When he dies, he goes to hell and Lazarus goes to heaven, and you have that wonderful dialogue between Lazarus and God. Not Lazarus in front of the rich man and God. Now in hell, he wants them to do something about his brothers who are left back there. We had last week the example of Zacchaeus, who was a very, very rich man because he was a tax collector. He was the number one tax collector for the government and the temple. And you noticed last week, when Jesus talks about Lazarus, he doesn't in any way condemn him. In fact, he says, I want to eat at your home today. I am your guest. And also Joseph of Arimathea, who came to Jesus somewhere in his ministry to the point where he and his wealth gave him the tomb in which he was going to be buried. There was no condemnation of the wealthy. In every story, Jesus did not condemn, he critiqued. And by critiquing, he was simply saying to you and me, the new paradigm about stewardship is a paradigm that has mercy for both the poor and the wealthy. Because in God's justice, the earth and its resources and the call to stewardship is for all of us. And to the wealthy of his time, he was able to say, if indeed you are a believer in God, then open your hearts to understand that you're creating a system that keeps these people where they are. You're participating, Jews, in the temple and in the occupying Roman government, participating together with them to keep these people in poverty. And that's what was wrong. But in Jesus' paradigm, we are able to question and to critique. I can critique myself in terms of the way I live, in my version of living the paradigm of God, the second one. And the most that I can come up with as far as solving problems is to say I do the best I can. But there are problems so vast and so enormous, and the world being what it is, we are so tied together in our economics, in our philosophies, in our politics, in so many different ways we are bonded together that it almost seems impossible. It seems an impossibility that we could ever, ever get back to the paradigm of Genesis, which was reiterated in the words of Jesus. And yet, brothers and sisters, we are called to understand and to somehow address the problem. I'd like to read a little bit more of William Sloan Coffin as he deals with just this issue, and I'll close with a little thing at the end. When I was a boy in public school, I was told that in America we have rich people and poor people, and there was no connection between them. Years later in New York City, I often heard well-to-do people say that while New York was the adrenaline capital of the world, the most exciting city in the world in which to live, quotes, we also have problems. We have a lot of poor people. Reading the Bible, I found defined differently. In the Bible, it's always the rich who are a problem to the poor, never the other way around. But in the New Testament, wealthy people like Zacchaeus receive sympathetic treatment by Jesus. Still, Jesus doesn't hesitate to generalize that it is harder for a rich person to enter into the kingdom than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. To quote Helder Camara, who was an archbishop who was murdered because of his work for justice, he says, I used to think when I was a child that Christ might have been exaggerating when he warned about the dangers of wealth. Today I know better. I know how hard it is to be rich and still keep the milk of human kindness. Money has a dangerous way of freezing people's hands, eyes, lips, and hearts. It's very hard to convert a heart, mind, and purse. It is very hard to have possessions and not become possessive, to be completely dependent upon God and independent of everything else. And so a prophetic concern for the poor should be matched by a pastoral concern for the wealthy. As I read the Bible, judgment against the rich spells mercy, not only for the poor, but finally for the rich as well. It suggests that just as the poor should not be left to the mercy of their poverty, so the rich should not be left at the mercy of their wealth. If a minimum wage job, there's more than symmetry to command a maximum wage. After all, the primary reward for a job well done is not a higher salary, but greater responsibilities. There's an enormous difference between justice in our country and justice everywhere in the world. In Sweden, for example, CEOs, as a general rule, make no more than 6 times the salary of their lowest paid employee. There is also, I'm told, a continuing debate with conservatives arguing for a 7-to-1 ratio, while radicals urge a 5-to-1 ratio. In America, it's sometimes 400-to-1, and there is no debate. It's very unnerving, and I'm sure you are just as unnerved as I am, when you hear reports or read, like in this week's paper, there was a whole article about people who are food insecure. Food insecure means that there are 50 million people in America who are living in poverty, most of whom don't have enough money to feed themselves. That's in 2013. It's very difficult to hear those things and very disappointing, because what do we do about it? I don't know what the solutions are. I don't know where we find the answer, but I do know this. About 4 days ago, Billy Graham preached what he called his last sermon. Maybe some of you saw part of it on television. And the thrust of his last sermon was very much the same thrust of his first sermon 70 years ago. But it rings so more powerfully today for me than it ever did before. And what he said was, these are my words, not his. He was suggesting that the world is in need of a new awakening, a new religious awakening. Because unless there is a religious awakening, there will be no more conscience in America. In fact, as religion wanes off in people's lives, and there's nothing left for people and for which they can grab after, the only thing left is economics and power and possession. Without a conscience, said Gandhi, economics is immoral. If there's anything to come today about stewardship for me, and I've been beating myself with this all week, and maybe for you, as we critique the world around us, we don't expect to find the answer. We don't expect to fix everything that's wrong. But God's not asking any one of us to do that. What God is asking is that we do in our own lives what we know to be God's will. And I use that very guardedly, because when you say God's will, I think of all the nuns and bishops and the priests who use that as an excuse to do anything they wanted to. Somehow, If we are believing people and Scripture speaks to us, that first paradigm about life should be the backdrop against which we live, because that's the same paradigm that Jesus reiterated in his life. I believe that there is hope yet in Christianity. I believe that perhaps this world, you know, the first great awakening in the 1700s started here with the preacher in this pulpit. There's a need for a second great awakening, because without it, look at the direction our world has gone. Step back far enough just to have a perspective in terms of how human life has been bartered off for wealth and profits, where people are collateral damage when there's wars, when people starve to death and nothing can be done about it, or nothing is done about it. As much as we may try, it doesn't change. That's the order of our world. There is a Swedish theologian person, prophet in his own way. His name was Havel. His last name was Havel, Vaclav Havel. And he said this to a large group of churches at one point in his life. Hope is not about coming to the resolution of something. Hope, and the opposite, is not hopelessness. Hope is, however something turns out, we will understand it and make use of it. However something turns out, we will begin to understand it and use it. We desperately need, brothers and sisters, to understand that as a Christian people, our stewardship of this earth goes no further than our yards if we choose. But in the vast scheme of things, to listen to prophetic voices, to encourage people of imagination, to support those who perhaps are in a position to make a difference about the injustices of our world, particularly in our own country. That, I think, is a necessary call. It is something that asks us to go beyond charity, beyond taking care of, into a world of justice where everyone has equal access to the world's resources and nobody holds the strings on all of it. That means a complete reversal. That's what metanoia is. That's what Jesus calls the wealthy people of his time to consider. And brothers and sisters, none of us are billionaires, but we are in so many ways, I know I am, wealthy compared to the billions in the world who have nothing. It's just a thought, something perhaps to chew on, something to pray about. Remember Jesus, she gave all she had from her poverty. God is looking for hearts. God is looking for soul. God is looking for commitments for us together. And as the cover on the bulletin very prophetically says, because I created it, together we shape God's presence for all generations. God's presence depends on us. Future generations depend on us.